Our second reading this morning is Judges chapter 8, but now I'm going to actually read Judges chapter 8. Then the men of Ephraim said to him, "What is this that you have done to us, not to call us when you went to fight against Midian?" And they accused him fiercely, and he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Ebiezer? God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you?" Then their anger against him subsided when he said this. And Gideon came to the Jordan and crossed over. He had 300 men who were with him, exhausted yet pursuing. So he said to the men of Succoth, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." And the officials of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give the bread to your army?" So Gideon said, "Well then Yahweh has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand. I will flail your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." And from there he went up to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way. And the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered. And he said to the men of Penuel, "When I come again in peace, I will break down this tower." Now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor with their army, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the army of the people of the east, for there had fallen 120,000 men who drew the sword. And Gideon went up by the way of the tent dwellers east of Nobah and Jogbeha and attacked the army. For the army felt secure. And Zeba and Zalmunna fled, and he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and he threw all the army into a panic. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres, and he captured a young man of Succoth and questioned him. And he wrote down for him the officials and elders of Succoth, 77 men. And he came to the men of Succoth and said, "Behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me, saying, 'Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give the bread to your men who are exhausted?' And he took the elders of the city, and he took thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them taught the men of Succoth a lesson. And he broke down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city." Then he said to Zeba and Zalmunna, "Where are the men whom you killed at Tabor?" They answered, "As you are, so were they. Every one of them resembled the son of a king." And he said, "They were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As Yahweh lives, if you had saved them alive, I would not kill you." So he said to Jether, his firstborn, "Rise and kill them." But the young man did not draw his sword, for he was afraid because he was still a young man. Then Zeba and Zalmunna said, "Rise yourself and fall upon us, for as the man is, so is his strength." And Gideon arose and killed Zeba and Zalmunna, and he took the crescent ornaments that were on their necks of their camels. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you and your son, and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian." Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. Yahweh will rule over you." And Gideon said to them, "Let us make a request of you. Let me make a request of you. Every one of you give me the earrings from his spoil." For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And they answered, "We will willingly give them." And they spread a cloak, and every man threw in the earrings of his spoil. After the weight of the golden earrings that was requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, and besides the collars that were around the necks of the camels. And Gideon made an ephod of it and put it in his city in Ophrah. And all Israel whored after it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and to his family. So Midian was subdued before the people of Israel, and they raised their heads no more, and the land had rest for 40 years in the days of Gideon. Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and lived in his own house. Now Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, and he called his name Abimelech. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash's father at Ophrah of the Abiezrites. As soon as Gideon died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. And the people of Israel did not remember Yahweh their God, who had delivered them from the hand of their enemies on every side, and they did not show steadfast love to the family of Jerubbaal, that is, Gideon, in return for all the good that he had done to Israel. This is the word of the Lord.
Panic there when Jordan started reading the wrong passage. I thought, oh man, I wrote the wrong sermon this week. So it all worked out in the end. I actually have a large sermon in a very small amount of time this morning, so I think we might get about through two-thirds of this sermon, and maybe I'll need to revisit this topic next week. This morning's second reading from Judges chapter 8 tells us a number of things about Gideon, about the remainder of his exploits, and about this ephod which he had created. Our first reading was a reading of the Ten Commandments, and I've brought those two readings together, the Ten Commandments and this passage from Judges chapter 8, because I wanted to talk with you this morning about idolatry and about what idolatry is and about what idolatry is not. So let me give you three conclusions right up front before this sermon gets lost in the weeds. Number one, idolatry can be worshiping a false god, any god beside Yahweh. Number two, idolatry can also be worshiping the one true God, but worshiping him in any way other than the way that God told us to worship him. And number three, in Colossians 3:5, the Apostle Paul tells us that greed or covetousness can also be idolatry. So I'm not going to talk about number three this morning. I'm hoping to be able to talk about the first two this morning. To begin, idolatry can be worshiping false gods, any god besides Yahweh, worshiping Baal or Molech or Athena or Odin or Ganesh or Gaia. All of these are idolatry. And of course, that's prohibited by the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me, is what we read in Exodus 20, verse 3. If you have your Bibles in front of you, you'll notice a little note next to the word before, which says that that word can also read beside. In other words, we are not to worship any god as superior to our God, but we're also not to worship any God alongside or in addition to our God. And that means we as Christians don't do Jesus and Buddha. We don't do Jesus plus Mother Earth. That's idolatry. Idolatry can be worshiping any God beside the one true God. But secondly, idolatry can also be worshiping the one true God in a false way, in any way other than the way that God instructs us to worship him. Now, this is more complicated, and so I want you to have your ears open and your thinking caps on. Let me, to begin, suggest seven examples of what might be worshiping the true God in a false way, in a way that God did not instruct us to worship him. Imagine somebody trying to worship the one true God by bowing down in front of a statue or a picture that had been painted to represent that God. Imagine someone trying to worship the one true God by flagellating themselves with whips or by having themselves hung on a cross. Imagine someone trying to worship the one true God by endlessly repeating a series of prayers and clicking off beads on a chain. Imagine someone trying to worship the one true God by slowly walking in an elaborately laid out prayer labyrinth. Imagine someone trying to worship the one true God by celebrating a milk and honey communion in honor of Sophia, the wisdom of God. Imagine someone trying to worship the one true God by entering a trance or an ecstatic state through the use of loud or repetitive music. Imagine someone trying to worship the one true God by passing out when the pastor slaps them on the forehead. I believe these seven examples are examples of idolatry, not because the person is trying to worship some God other than the one true God. These might be seven examples of idolatry because the person is trying to worship God in a way that they have invented and not in the way that God has instructed us to worship him. That's actually what the second commandment is about. We read in Exodus 20, "You shall not make for yourself a graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is under the water of the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." It is a mistake to think of the second commandment as a prohibition against making images of fake gods, like Baal or Ashtaroth. Fake gods were dealt with in the first commandment. The second commandment is a prohibition against making images of the one true God or of anything that's been created by the one true God. You all remember the story of the golden calf that was made by Aaron when Moses was up on Mount Sinai. Moses had been gone for a while, and so the people became anxious, and in their anxiety, they demanded a visible reminder of the presence of God who had rescued them. And so Aaron makes for them a calf. This calf was not an Egyptian god. This calf was not a new divinity invented by Aaron. This calf, in fact, was a visible symbol of Yahweh. Not a picture of Yahweh, but a picture of a beast on which Yahweh could ride around on. Think of it as God's golden Cadillac. We can't make an image of God, but here's his car. And let's gather around his car and offer sacrifices and worship to the invisible driver. So what's wrong with that? By bowing down before the golden calf, the Israelites were trying to worship Yahweh. They were honoring the one who had rescued them out of Egypt. Isn't that okay? Actually, as it turns out, it's not okay. Idolatry is not only worshiping a false god, idolatry is also trying to worship the one true God in a way that we have invented rather than in the way that God has commanded. And we're going to talk more about that later. Let me talk about some distinctions between Protestants and Catholics. John Calvin was not the most quotable man, but if there is one phrase you know from the 16th century Swiss reformers, it is this: man's nature is a perpetual factory of idols. Man's nature is a perpetual factory of idols. What Calvin is saying is that naturally, by just the way we are always creating new idols. That sentence appears in the Institutes of the Christian Religion, which Calvin's encyclopedic introduction to the basics of Reformed Christianity. We can think of it as a 1,000-page, we can think of this 1,000-page work as Calvin's version of the Westminster Confession of Faith, which is the fundamental statement of faith amongst Presbyterians. The Protestant Reformation produced many of these doctrinal statements, some of them quite large, because the reformers were trying to define what they understood to be true biblical Christianity. And in the process, they were drawing distinctions between the newer Reformed churches and the older Roman Catholic churches, which they had all grown up in. If I were to ask you, what are some of the key differences between the Roman Catholic Church and a Protestant church? You might say, well, Roman Catholic clergy are not allowed to marry, but Protestant pastors are free to do so. That's a big difference. Martin Luther, the man who sparked the Protestant Reformation in 1517, he had been a Roman Catholic priest. In 1523, 5 years after the Reformation began, Luther helped 12 nuns escape from a convent. I know this sounds like a joke. He actually smuggled them out in fish barrels. And then 2 years later, he married one of these nuns. Now, it was not a shotgun wedding. So, married clergy is a big difference between Protestants and Catholics. Two other important differences are that Protestants don't pray to saints or to the Virgin Mary, and Protestant lay people are encouraged to read the Bible and to read it in their own language. In 1521, the Diet of Worms had declared that Luther was a heretic. He was supposed to be executed, but a local prince hid him in Wartburg Castle, and while Luther was there in the castle, Luther translated the Bible into German. That translation is still used today and enjoys the same kind of respect that our King James Version enjoys in the English-speaking world. Another big difference between Protestant and Catholic churches you see when you walk into any sanctuary. A typical Catholic church will be full of statues and holy images, while Protestant churches can be rather plain and bare. My parents were missionaries in Switzerland in the 1950s and the 1960s, and that means that I was born in Zurich, which is the largest city in Switzerland, and in the center of Zurich is the Grossmünster, the great cathedral, which dates from the 12th century. When the Protestant Reformation arrived in Zurich in 1520, the pastor at the Grossmünster was Ulrich Zwingli. Now, when my son was born, I wanted to have him named Ulrich Zwingli. Okay? We settled on John Calvin. Okay? It's good enough. So Zwingli had all of the statues removed and all of the paintings on the walls and the ceilings whitewashed. They even removed the pipe organ. Now today, if you go visit the Grossmünster, they have got a new pipe organ. They put it back in. But the walls are still plain and the ceiling is white. These changes were made during the Protestant Reformation because the reformers believed that the Catholic Church was guilty of idolatry, was guilty of violating the second commandment, which forbids the making of graven images for use in worship. Well, while I'm mentioning this, I invite you to look around you And let me give you a little historical commentary on our sanctuary. When our church was built in 1860, and the original part of the building is there in the back, our windows were clear glass. If you want to see what this church used to look like, there are two very similar examples nearby. One is St. John of the Savior Church, the Episcopal Church, up Welsh Road on the way to Willow Grove, and the other is the Southampton Primitive Baptist Church up there on Street Road. Okay, you can go look at those churches, and you can kind of get a picture of what our church looked like in 1860. They're almost identical. In the 1930s, the original plain windows were replaced with the stained glass that you see in the back. Okay, you'll notice that those stained glass windows don't have any people or animals in them. They're simply decorative patterns. And then in the 1950s, this portion of the sanctuary was added, and a series of windows with scenes from the life of Jesus were installed. Now, I should tell you that these windows are not typical of a Presbyterian or a Reformed church. If you go to Princeton Theological Seminary, on the campus is Miller Chapel, and if you go into Miller Chapel, you will see clear glass windows, plain white walls. The same is true of other grand Presbyterian churches like First Presbyterian Church of Chestnut Hill in Philadelphia or First Presbyterian Church in Princeton. Plain white walls, clear glass windows, no decorations, no images at all. Now, if this seems like splitting hairs over fine points of doctrine, you should know that we have had Brazilian visitors in our congregation scandalized by the images in our sanctuary. They look around them and they feel like they're in a Catholic church. And because they come from a country where the Protestant church is a minority and the struggle between Catholic and Protestant is still more real, it feels for them a little hostile. In fact, in the early service, we don't light these candles because that feels too Catholic for them. Now, I don't know what the purpose or the meaning of the candles is. Personally, I like them. But these objects, used in a religious context, can feel idolatrous to some people. In our reading from Judges this morning, we have the end of the story of Gideon, and in verse 27 we read, "And Gideon made an ephod and put it in the city of Ophrah, and all Israel whored after it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and to his family." Now the word "whored" in this verse is the word that is used throughout the Old Testament to describe idolatry. So what's going on here? An ephod was a special vest that was made for Aaron, Moses' brother, and it was part of his equipment or his vestment as the high priest. Here's the description from Exodus 28. "They shall receive gold and blue and purple and scarlet yarn and fine twisted linen. Then they shall make the ephod of gold, of blue, of purple, of scarlet yarns, and of fine twisted linen, skillfully worked. It shall have two shoulder pieces attached to its two edges so that it may be joined together." Now there was one and only one ephod. It was a sign of the office of the high priest. You might think of it as the papal tiara, you know, that special three-tiered crown that only the Pope can wear. The Bible does not say that Gideon wore this ephod. There is no indication that Gideon took to himself any priestly function or made himself into some kind of pope. The text simply says Gideon made an ephod and put it in Ophrah. Maybe it was on a mannequin. Maybe it was hanging up on a pole. Most likely, by this point in history, the ephod of Aaron had disappeared. And so when Gideon makes an ephod, this ephod becomes a visible sign of the access to God the Israelites once had when Aaron was around. Seeing the ephod no doubt gave them some kind of intense religious feeling. Think of the Shroud of Turin, which some claim is the burial garment of Jesus. People travel from all over the world to see this physical object because they feel it will make them closer to God. Of course, the object isn't God. Everybody knows that. But what if I get a special feeling when I'm near this object? Is there some kind of special power there? Will my prayers be more surely answered at that shrine? Do you see why it could be easy to start whoring after such a thing? And what about tours of the Holy Land? We Protestants love that kind of thing. We visit Bethlehem and we visit the Garden of Gethsemane and the Wailing Wall. We get baptized again in the Jordan River. We bring home little bottles of water from the Jordan and we get crosses made from olive trees. Is it possible that the attraction to these physical objects or these physical places which have some kind of historical connection with Jesus, is it possible that our attraction to those is a kind of idolatry? Now, I'm historically minded and I love old things. George Hinley and I recently took a road trip and we visited President Warren G. Harding's house in Marion, Ohio. It was great. It was interesting to see the president's bookcases and his cigar holders. We weren't allowed to take any pictures in the house. It was like a holy shrine. But I snuck away from the group and took a few pictures of his bathroom. I can show them to you. The physical connection between great men and important history, I understand this. And so I understand why in Europe there are churches full of relics of saints and people go to see those relics, the bones of the heroes of the faith. But is there a danger of idolatry in all of that? If my feeling of closeness to God is being created by certain physical objects, am I in danger of idolatry? So Joyce Fleming, during the passing of the peace, asked me, so can you tell me why you wear the robe on certain days and not on other days? This is called a Geneva robe, okay? It's called the Geneva robe because this is the kind of robe that John Calvin wore when he preached in Geneva. He wore this kind of robe because he was a lawyer, and this is the kind of clothing that a lawyer wore. He wore the robe specifically to show that he wasn't a priest. Okay, so he was wearing the clothes of his profession, which was a lawyer. If he had been a carpenter, he would have worn overalls. All right? So why do I wear the robe? Sometimes I wear the robe, some people are very attached to the robe. Pastor feels holier when he's wearing the robe. The service seems more dignified when the pastor is wearing the robe. When that kind of feeling emerges, I take the robe off. There are other people who say, you know, that's like way too Catholic to wear a robe. He should be wearing like a suit, like a normal Protestant preacher, like Pastor Bruno. When I start hearing that feeling, I put on the robe, okay? Because if you're attached to this because this is more holy, or if you think that Bruno is more holy because he's not wearing a robe, you're missing the point, okay? Both of these are examples of idolatry. It's not the closeness to the physical object that counts. We've run out of time. We're gonna talk about this a little more next week, but I wanna invite the band forward, and they can lead us in some more